Good evening, everybody, and thank you so much for taking time to come, braving the bridge. I was so nervous today because I knew there were some five meetings happening and it was almost worse than Bombay. So for everyone who's crossed the bridge, thank you so much. The project that we see, the book, has been a decade-long project. When we planned the release today, we said it had to be with all of you, our family, friends, old neighbors, good neighbors, and all our close friends. And many, many of you were very close to Grandpa. Grandpa, or Andrew, as many people know him, or Uncle Andrew, was such a great storyteller. We all remember his stories, the dim light in the evening, his expression. And then just when it came to the climax, Grandpa would inevitably get up to turn the fish or to take a sip of fainy and then like, Grandpa, but then what happened? And it's my big regret that we didn't capture his stories on camera. But I think the book, Daddy's done a pretty good job in getting many, many of the things that we remember. You know, I feel our stories are very, very powerful. And a tremendous part of our heritage and our legacy. It gives us a reason to be, it enlightens us, it connects us and binds us. And that's why I kept on getting asked by Dad to record all these stories. And while it's essentially the story of Grandpa and Grandma, it's also the story of many, many, many people here, many vignettes, because Grandpa and Grandma were so large-hearted that their lives intersected many people's lives. And just to give you a little flavor, Frederick asked me especially, said many times when you go for a book release, people don't really know. I just wanted to read some things that struck me. Grandma Leopoldina was Grandma's mother. And the book starts with Leopoldina had just been informed at mass that Rangoon had been bombed by the Japanese. This had happened just before Christmas 1941. That hundreds of people had been killed. Her son Andrew and his family, her daughter Bibinda and her family, and her younger son Jerry were all in Rangoon. She had no news of them, and indeed had reason to be worried. She had no news either of her husband Sylvester Philip, from the other end of the world in Montreal. He had gone with the Maharaja of Nikari in 1917 to join the Allied forces in France during World War I. When the war ended, he did not return, but instead went on to Canada, where gold had just been discovered. So then he goes on a bit about that. And then Leopoldina immediately went to Saigon, hoping that her mother, whose brother and eldest son were also in Burma, and other families having relatives in Burma may have some information. Beyond confirming that Rangoon had been bombed, nobody had any further information though. All they could do was wait and pray. I think in today's day when technology is so fast and quick and we have a lovely network called World Cousins, and many people here are from that network, in a second we're getting photographs from Australia, we know what's happening in Canada. But I just thought, what would it have been for Grandma Leopoldina to have her entire family and not know for months, I mean maybe a whole month before you know if they're alive or not. That was the kind of period that you're looking at. And for me, who knew Grandpa much better, because Grandma died when I was just 10 and I never knew Grandma Leopoldina. Grandpa was always the life of the party, he was always so outgoing. But in this book, I really realized what strength both these women had. Grandma Ivy came to Goa after the war, and I was just thinking about it. Though she was born, she was never born here, she didn't know the language, and suddenly she went from Rangoon, which was an urban city, to a village, and had to completely settle in, manage with two small children. And just to give you something that struck me,
we have the general.
போய் நாங்கள் போடேன்
you would like to call the general here?
No, he said he wants to paint the audience.
No?
He said, no. At National and now, we had security, that's daddy writing, of a house and basic food that was after they left from the war. But we had no ready money for day-to-day expenses. I promptly set about finding a job. I mean, here's a person who's never ever been in Goa. She was informed that Manuel de Cruz from National owned St. Xavier's High School at Moira. She approached him for a teacher's job. When he read her certificates and heard of her teaching experience, he was quick to offer her a job of a headmistress. He had been unable to send up students for the matriculation examinations in Bombay without a properly qualified headmistress. She had just fulfilled this requirement. We immediately started school, IB at the high school building and IZME at the primary school building. The book also captures a lot of life in Goa in the 1940s with the great planning of Kolkata's agro industries, cultivating of the fields, her neighborhood, her web snake, as well as her buffaloes, and there's very some good stories about that which I won't go into just now. But the book traces the entire family journey from Burma to Goa, then to Calcutta, Burma again, then Bombay, and finally Goa. They went through World War II riots in Calcutta, and it's a story that tells us how many times we had to start from scratch. When everything was lost, one thing that kept them all together, they were bolstered by the family, by deep faith, and a lot of personal grit. There are many, many stories. This also, I felt, is not just one family story, but also capturing a whole period of life in Burma, which many, many people don't know about, especially the army, the Indian army's contribution to the World War II in Burma. And life in Goa in the 40s, and then very interestingly, life in Goa in the 60s, which Daddy has written about over his experiences. I'd like to hand over to the panel. I just introduced you before. Jerry, today we're really grateful to have Jerry with us. He was in Goa, he went back to Bombay, he came only for this book release. Thank you, Jerry. And Jerry, many of you may have read his book, that's really an amazing book, Jerry is an award-winning writer, with apart from many other interests. Mr. Ferrero, many people know here, he was the ex-Union Commissioner, IQA Minister, NRI Commissioner, played a very critical role there. We are very grateful to have him here. He's come all the way from the south. Thank you very much, sir. And he's also very much part of the kind of one life that he, what has been narrated in the book. Before I finish, I just have to say that this book would not have happened without Frederick. I can't see him anywhere.
He's gone to publish it.
He's gone to publish another one, Jerry. But Frederick actually gave us the confidence, and so Dad is going to publish the book. And today we see the final version. It's really thanks to Frederick. Ulrike, another cousin, many of you know, helped put a form and structure to this book. And thank you to many, many family members who shared all their experiences, connecting their data. Neela D'Souza played a very important part at the end by giving us an outsider's view. Thank you. Thank you to all the people who made this possible. I'd like to hand over to Jerry.
Like every Goan, when I was reading the book, my first question was, where's my family in the book? Because there's a certain band of Goans who are all related to each other. And, you know, in general, a Machado marries a Pinto, and that Pinto man from Moira only, that one, that Pinto, that Nachnola Pinto, they're not my auntie or whatever. And then, as I was reading the book, I found that we weren't there, which is quite disappointing. And suddenly towards the end, there is the description of the three of the Oliver triplets. Now this Oliver triplets, there were three girls who were born in Burma. And they were not, I mean, you know, generally triplets have a very bad hit rate. I mean, they don't survive terribly long because they're always born underweight. These triplets were also joined at the head. So they had to be separated. But they were such pretty triplets that they eventually were used in the Cow and Gate milk powder ad. Okay? And Aloysius has got all this dope inside, and that's my Auntie Gertie and her three daughters, Yvonne, Hilary, and Rose. Marie, they're not mentioned, but he's got it so accurately that he even traces Yvonne, who is now in the St. Anthony's home for the aged. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, with this, she was called the Texan drawl because she spoke with a Texan accent, largely because of her ear impairing because of the joining up of the ears. I would advise everybody in the audience to get several copies of this book, because you'll be able to give it to friends who will also be doing exactly this, which is looking up the Machados and the Pimentos and the Menezeses and the Corla Sousas, who all turn up in a grand parade of Goan Roman Christianity, all walking through the pages in extremely strange situations. It is leavened with great humor, so that when Aloysius is talking about his great grandmother, he points out that when she was bringing the kundlis to the table, her hands would shake and the curry would fall on the floor. But when she was given a glass of fane full to the brim, she did not drop a single drop. Then there's a lovely moment of illumination, which I think all of us could learn from, which is when he's working with the Salgaonkars. And there is a union that has to be formed, mainly because someone is trying to break the barge operator's strike. The barge operators are on strike. Various political parties are playing their politics. And Mr. D'Souza, who is at the back, the eminence grise of forming the union and getting the people organized so that they will get their just dues, tells us that his informers were the drivers of the high and mighty, because all discussions would happen in the back seat and the drivers calmly sitting in the front seat, paying no attention, listening to everything, absorbing everything, recording it and replaying it later. It's a wonderful moment which tells us something about our caste system and our hierarchy, which is we almost treat our servants as if they don't exist. You know, they're sort of like invisible, and then we're really surprised when they know so much about us. There is so much, I mean, this book takes in so many geographic zones. It starts, of course, in Goa, goes to Burma, comes back to Calcutta, goes to the heart of India, travels to Mount Abu, goes to Rajasthan, comes, you know, travels into Mau, into the central, into the heart of India, goes up to, it's almost breathtaking how many times the family seems to have been able to pull up stakes and do it all again without effort. It has its share of tragedies too, and upsets. And Aloysius is terribly discreet about them. He tells them with a light hand, I think, drawing a curtain across what was probably severe family discord and anger and things like that. But those are, you know, if you're a Goan, you know exactly the scenes that would have played out when, say, a well-loved son decides to leave the priesthood, or when a young man won't turn up for the inventor of the family, you know, and everybody else is wondering why, where he is. So I think in that sense, the hints are there. There is no point at which there is an elision or there is a covering up and this is something Goans are very good at doing, I think, covering up the bits and pieces of family history that we don't want to talk about. Aloysius has done a great job in talking about them, but in a matter-of-fact manner that suggests this is what happened, and now you know what people were probably saying and doing at that time, how people were reacting. So, apart from it being an extremely valuable mine of information, which is anthropological, social, historical, and human, at one very basic level, human, there's another link I found with the book. At one of the first festivals, of Goa at the Goa Arts and Literary Festival, Yvonne Vaz Ezdani, was to read from Songs of the Survivors, a book she had written on the people who had trekked from Burma overland into Assam in 1942. Now, and as soon as I heard that this book was done, I thought, Deepika, what happened to your book? Because Deepika had,
right from the beginning. Yeah,
many years even before that, Deepika and I had sat down and talked about this magnificent migration, Indians doing this brave walk across tiger-infested territory. And the tigers didn't take so many Indians as the mosquitoes did. Malaria, children buried along the way, old people left behind. It was a terrible, tragic walk. My grandfather arrived back from, had left Rangoon with a head full of black hair and arrived in Calcutta completely grey and never ever would talk about what he had seen along the way. But he had screaming nightmares almost every day of his life. This book then, when I was asked to launch it, and I was delighted to, because I believe we are so callous about our history, so uncaring about circumstance. We've forgotten most of it. We allow most of it to just fall away. But I thought it wasn't all that it could be. It wasn't as powerful a book as I expected it to be. And so when Yvonne told me that she was doing a fresh version, I said, I would be delighted if you would send it to me to edit. And so I edited it, we worked on it together, and it was published by Speaking Tree. Some of the characters from that book actually married into the Aloysius D'Souza family, which proves my point that if you in Goa, there's only about 90 families, and they're all married to each other. And if you inquire too far about an enemy that you've made in Goa, you will probably discover that she is a blood relative and you shouldn't be like too mad at her, because your worst traits are reflected in her behavior. Thank you so much, Aloysius, for having me over. Thank you, Deepika, for inviting me. And thank you for giving us all the opportunity of reading this wonderful family history, which resonates, I think, which will resonate with every single family of every Goan who reads it, and of many diasporic families across the world. I wish the book every success, and I think it will have it simply because of the almost encyclopedic detail that has gone into its building. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I should say something?
Yes, sir.
I don't have a just to
go. No.
Mr. Aloysius D'Souza, Mr. Jerry Pinto, Mrs. Deepika Karwala, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. We have very distinguished people here. You yourself, gentlemen, you should begin with. You are the chief of our forces, Army, Navy, and Air Force, Commander. Very Vice Admiral John De Silva, we worked together. And Mrs. Aurora Cole, an eminent writer. All of you, and all of you distinguished people, permit me, dear my colleagues here, lawyers and others, it's a great pleasure and it's a privilege to be here, distinguished ladies and gentlemen, at the release of this book, Homeward Bound, by Mr. Aloysius D'Souza. It's a wonderful book. It depicts the life of Goans and Indians and other people in Burma somewhere during those days. And the life of Goans those days, his childhood and mine are more or less at the same time. And when he writes about life in Nacionala, it was just like life in the Raya, which is my village in the south. You know, there were no electricity, there were no water supply, there were no cars, you know, people used to walk and the maximum go on a bicycle. And they were happy because they didn't know anything better, no better life. And therefore, it touches my heart because it's the first book that I have read that describes so well, so minutiously, and so perfectly life as it was when I was 7, 8 years old. It's a beautiful book. And then, life in Burma. Goans have been migrating to to other countries much before the colonial boom. They were of course migrating from the rest of India to Bombay, Pune, Bangalore, Kolkata, Karachi, undivided India, and Burma and other countries of Southeast Asia, those days. They were doing that. And what happened in Burma during the days that your book recalls, in December 1941, the Japanese attacked, bombed, and destroyed large number. And there was a large colony of bones there, a potential colony, considering our population. And I suppose that in Rangoon, most of the population, or the largest part of the population, were of Indians. Indians were a large number there. And when the bombing took place, most of them perhaps left. Some of them were lucky to go by air or by ship, but most have to go walking, by mules, by a bullock, and walking across the border. Many die on the way. You described it so well and so perfectly, and it's very touching. Goans have been doing that. Those days they were going in the pre-colonial days for all these countries and other parts of India. In the colonial days also continued that trend, and then they started going also to East Africa, the Portuguese colony, then the British colony of Mozambique, Kenya, Tanganyika, then now is Tanzania, Tanganyika, Kenya, and so on. And then when the independence took place of those countries, they started moving, and after now they are moving towards the west, to Europe, United Kingdom, North America, Canada, and so on. Now you see a big queue there at the Portuguese consulate waiting for the Portuguese passport. Many people find that anti-national. It's not particularly anti-national, because most countries now, there are enormous number of countries in the world that permit not just dual nationality, multiple nationalities. There are countries that permit multiple nationalities. Many permit dual nationality. There are many others also that don't permit dual nationality, like India, like China, like Japan, and several others. So this is permitted. But anyhow, when it's done, where you can take a passport of the country, you take the passport not out of less love for the country, but you get employment and job and things of the sort. But what, when you have a dual nationality, one must do, you must feel very strongly Indian. That is one of the Western countries also invite their citizens with dual nationality. They permit dual nationality, but say, keep yourself, with your that original nationality, be strong on that, and proceed there just for the sake of the job. But they are doing that. We ourselves, in India, during Mr. Narasimha Rao's time, we thought of permitting dual nationality. But we didn't do that because of the particular situation in this region of ours. We have a lot of people in all the neighboring countries, and giving them dual nationality could create problems. So therefore, dual nationality was not given. But then we decided on overseas citizen of India and person of Indian origin. Now, everyone who has Indian, including Goans, of course, who has a foreign nationality, they are entitled to be a certificate of overseas citizen of India. You give this person with the foreign nationality of Indian origin all the rights of Indian citizen, except the person cannot vote, cannot get a government job. Very exceptional can get a government job if he's so exceptionally qualified and if his qualifications are required here. Can't do that and can't buy agricultural property. Can sell agricultural property, but he can't buy that. Which makes no difference. You can be here forever. For as long as you want, you don't require a visa, you just require your certificate, overseas citizen of India, come and go and stay as long as you want. So therefore, that was the solution. And I suppose it is broadly on the lines of what our neighboring country, Pakistan, has. Pakistan permits dual nationality, but the person with the foreign nationality, maybe dual nationality, is not entitled to vote for government job or buy agricultural land. It's a similar situation that we have here. So Goans have been migrating to other countries, especially one of our communities, one of our large part of our population, has a tradition of migrating to foreign countries. First to neighboring countries, then to Africa, then after independence, the colonies of Africa in another situation, to Europe, North America, Canada. But now they must think about the difficulties they are going to get and they are already getting in foreign countries, particularly Western countries. You have Mr. Trump already telling us how it's going to be, and you have Brexit in England as a law, which is going to make it practically impossible for our people to go and obtain jobs in England. Our people need to migrate at a humbler level as cooks and butlers, at the higher level of the government servant and other employment, basically for employment, and very few for self-employment. And what is very important today, and I would like to assert this from my knowledge of the world situation, is that our people should leave that situation of empregados, getting jobs and working for somebody else, and do self-employment. In my time, when we were in our childhood, we used to look down upon those who were having a business or a shop. The Posarkar Mare, and can give you word of heart, the Posarkar, the Antibasin, the Sarkar again, the Sona. And take the money, Posarkar, the British were all Posarkars. They were a nation of shopkeepers, and they created the greatest empire in the world. So our children, our grandchildren, future generations, self-employment of any sort, rather than employment for some working for somebody else. That is what we must do. It's very important that our education system should be guided towards self-employment. People should be trained towards self-employment. And that is the priority. And once again, I thought I would say these things because these things are very important. This is what we must do now. Especially my community must do now. They're always looking for jobs. Must do now. Start their own thing. Harvest small and then it grows. So therefore, once again, sir, your book is wonderful. Nationala and Gaya must have been very close to each other, emotionally, very similar. Rice curry, chapatis, bakriyo, and all the type of things that you described so well was there in Nationala and was in Gaya too, sir. Wonderful book. Thank you very much. I thank you on behalf of the people of Goa for this beautiful book. Thank you very much.
You know, I was wondering about the beginning of the book. Can you tell us a little about the process that led you to deciding to write a book? Because when I tell people to write books, like I've told my friend Jennifer Mirza, for instance, that she should be writing her memoir, the standard is, but what man, what I did, I didn't have any. Actually, I feel like hitting people on the head and saying, you start writing it and you'll discover how interesting your own life was. So was it difficult for Aloysius to sit down and do the work?
So as I said, actually the biggest storyteller was Grandpa, and the regret still is that we didn't get it in 3D because we had all the technology. We should really have recorded it then and there with just a simple video camera. But all the time, especially when he passed away, I really felt that we can't let those stories die, and I kept battling that because I grew up with people saying, just down the road he lived, and I'm saying, but that person doesn't live there. It could be 40 years ago in Burma. everybody's imagination and their memories and associations were so tied to Burma that you just grew up feeling that they were there. And I said that that had to be captured. So it started with almost more than 10 years back when after Grandpa passed away, I said we must record it. So in the beginning, we went and just recorded people's stories. Uncle Peter's story, New Nashville, Jerry Khan. We just met people and talked to people and just recorded their stories, took it down with and we didn't look for form and structure. We just took it all down. And as it grew on and on, then Dad finally decided that, you know, I need the story I know best is mine. And he started to just pen that down. And most that the story was there in a word format on his computer. And then Ulrike came, and Ulrike was a journalist, and she added a lot of her own inputs to it and gave it a kind of a structure. So really, from when it started to now, it's been 10 years, but I think it was really worth it because in that process, so many more people were involved and so many more stories came about.
You know, at this point I feel I should tell you that I know that you haven't read the book yet because it's just been launched. But one of the things that you know, when you've read the book, you'll probably discover is the question that you wanted to ask was probably in your mind even now. And you probably didn't ask it only because you wondered if it was a silly question. And that there's no such thing as a silly question. Just go ahead and ask anything you feel like. And someone on the panel will try and answer you in the way that they can. It's as simple as that. No one who has an encyclopedia from which they can read out the perfect and full answer. And therefore there are no perfect and full questions there.
Okay, good now.
A person that should be congratulated is you, Mr. Frederick Rona.
Oh, Rona.
Yeah.
Yay!
Because the first book that you published
was about Burma.
Yes.
The Songs of Survivors by their wonderful writer, Yvonne Yazdani. And now with almost 100 books that you have published, single-handed almost, and also about Burma. You deserve all the support and all the good wishes.
Would you like to go here. Come on.
No. Okay, those who can do and those who can't publish. In the audience, there are some of my authors who have troubles to publish and late. So, you know, I won't make any claims on that behalf. But the fact of the matter is that it's enormously rewarding to get someone to tell their story and to discover that they have their own story in them, which at some level makes a lot of sense in for us to understand the world. Thanks.
No. Yes, indeed, Jennifer. Come to the stage and just speak in the mic. Now, Jennifer, please.
No, I'm sorry, there's no other
traveling mic.
Growing up in Bombay in the 50s, even though we lived in a multi-cultural setup in Bombay Central, by and large Christian families, Muslims were accepted and Hindus were accepted, friendly. We weren't antagonistic, but we tended to keep to ourselves because we went to see the church and stuff. I know that my friend in Xavier's College, her father, a Muslim, trekked from Burma to India.
Yeah.
Same similar story. So also the CPM leader Prakash Karat's family also trekked back. I wanted to know if this book captures only the gold migrants or when they were there, did they mix with the other community that were in Burma? Because in Bombay, we think it is a cosmopolitan place. By and large, we were not antagonistic, but we kept to each other.
Jennifer is a wonderful example of keeping to her community. Having married Saeed Mirza and her her sister Jean having married a Kalgutkar, which is a lot of keeping to your community. I know, you were the exceptions rather than the rule. You will find, I think, you know, in general, this book is very much about the community, about the Christian community, and almost specifically about the Roman Catholic Goan community in Rangoon. I think that's largely because there was, as you said, in Goa, it is possible probably to have more strong ties with Hindus and with other people of other communities than when you are in a ghetto like Bombay. Because Bombay eventually, like many cities, forces people into ghettos. You arrive in the city, you don't know where you live, then someone says, your kind of people live there, you know. So you go there and you find somebody, a landlady or someone who will give you shelter, and you find yourself embedded in that part of the community. And this is even true of Hindus, because the Hindus will use caste as a separator. So the Pathare Prabhus will go somewhere, but the Kayasths will go somewhere else, and the Khatris will land somewhere. It's sad, but we do seem to be a bit of a tribal race. Largely we seek out our tribe and we stay with them. Though I have great hopes from young people who seem to be much more uncaring about these things. Yeah. So that, for instance, Yari Road in Andheri is struggler territory. It's where everyone who comes to become a Hindi film star goes and lives. They live in Yari Road. And because this is the common dream is Hindi films rather than, finding a job or whatever, they become united by that larger dream. Yeah. So I think you're right. This book will not talk about that. You will not find too many Muslim names or Hindu names, but it reflects, I think, the sensibilities of a certain time and also the record keeping of a certain time. Our records are generally better because we have parishes and registers. You know, so you can look up anything you want to in the parish register. Whereas, I mean, you know, yeah, sorry, and Frederick.
You know, things are also changing with time. Like, it's a new generation thing, so the younger generation is thinking across communities. Having said that, our first book we generally refer to was by Yvonne Bardal, and it again looked like a whole Catholic community. But thanks to people like Jerry, it was taken to the national level. And they realized that there was, you know, a whole story of Indians in Burma which was not being told. So the story of Goans in Burma was told very well. Recently, published an edition called More Songs of the Survivors, or it was called Songs of the Survivors, and that includes the whole Pan-India story.
Yeah.
You know, people from Tamil Nadu and people from all over. So in that sense, you know, this is a tale running at all.
Now on this question of the communities in Burma is now Myanmar, according to this context. Now the communal tensions have increased in Myanmar, particularly against the Muslims. Now when I was in Dhaka some years ago, somewhere near Dhaka I saw a big camp of refugees, Rohingyas. Rohingyas are Muslims from Burma, from Myanmar, who are being thrown out or leave Myanmar because they are being harassed and killed and all type of torture and all type of harassment. And I saw them living in miserable conditions in a camp, a refugee camp, large extended camp, on the floor, sleeping on the floor, the children, the women and everybody and stuff. Very sad. This communal feeling is increasing all over the world. You see, and that is very unfortunate.
Yes. You'll have to come a little.
I think you'll
hear. Pop on.
Yeah.
Say much. But I may have said, I have to use a stick now. But when this war broke out, I was only 7, and we left in great stress. Jerry left me from his parents, and we actually went and came in the car, a Sigma, where people prepare their own cars. And Danny took us in his small car all the way to Pokhara. And there we lived in a very big bungalow, sharing it with many others. I don't know whether it's mentioned here. And there are so many people who just move very little kids. And we as children sort of, you know, dug the trench. Now not straight, but like this, into a U. And that is how we used to carry us with blankets around us. Okay, and we used to live there. Sometimes we get into heat, we get into sleep. The air was so good. And when the air inside went again, my parents, especially the medical and my relatives, would run to see the plane that was coming up. And see the Burmans, the real Burmese, knocking out gold from their feet, you know. They were so greedy, they wanted the jazz. And I didn't want them. But this is also happening in Goa, I tell you. Our boats are leaving Goa, and outsiders are coming in to buy for clothes. What are we coming to? Huh? Are we so grateful? Some of us are very mean to our own parents. What are our senior citizens doing in Goa? See, no one was up and about in that university. I am not a mother, I should not run around here with my six children. And daddy kept saying, Isaac, you're my only daughter. I only have one daughter. Please come and stay with me. Daddy has said, you got me married so many years ago. And I came here first, and then after that, you left Bombay within a few years and came down to live with me, and then they came to this house. They were the first couple to live in this wilderness. And it's very, very sad. You know, daddy used to have to go to Bombay. Mommy would be alone. So two or three of my sons would come and sleep there. And cycle back when my mommy used to be in Lourdes Colony or with the catch of us two widows. It is very, very hard not having a nice function. The army is here. William is here. There was no one there. Only Isaac, Frank built the house for Danny with his brother, two engineers. But it's so sad. It's so really very sad. We don't want anything that is not ours. We are very happy with Savion. And we have a little bars, Auchi bar. I don't know whether you know what Auchi bar is.
Go Vaz!
That even though we left Burma in that terrible fear, we have got the energy and God's grace to settle down. And thank all for this.
Thank you.
Thank my new special. And the Holy Family here for lifting us up. Bye.
Can you come up to the mic? Just a little, please. Just come up a little. Thank you. Hang on.
But I didn't see, I didn't know anything about how Alex's
He wants you to answer that, Daddy. But you mentioned it in the book.
Just tell him. Yes, say what you. What
no,
you
Daddy can answer.
Details, details.